show will be on case 19 in the Book of Serenity. Case 19 is entitled Yudman's Sumer. Introduction. I always admire the novel devices of Yudman. All his life he pulled out nails and wedges for people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a roll of glue or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road, trying to discern? A monk asked Yunmen, without producing a single thought, is there fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumer. Verse, not producing a single thought, Mount Sumer. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you come doubting, it's so high you can't get hold. A blue ocean is wide. The white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as the tip of a hair in there. A phony cockroach can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion. So I want to thank everybody for sitting so well, this morning, sitting so still, and sitting so powerfully. Really wonderful practice. As I mentioned last night, things, it's been a rough patch, right? We had those nightmarish years of President Trump.
African-American psychiatrist whom I've known for
15 years, and whenever we would have parties, New Year's parties, he was there with his partner. And both he and his partner got COVID, and he died. Other people died. Plainfield is a very large Hispanic population, so we had very large, we had very high death rates. I didn't get COVID. I'm lucky. I was able to sequester. And we got vaccinated. My wife and I got vaccinated at the end of February, actually. I'm working the phones, trying to find a shot somewhere. But even if you didn't get COVID, and even if you didn't lose your job, lots of people lost their jobs. It's like it still has the effect of undermining your trust. And that's true also for something like Afghanistan. We're walking away from, we probably should never have gotten in that mess. But we're walking away from that mess, and lots of people are going to suffer. And even if we see it on the news and we turn the channel, right, it's in our minds, it's in our world. So there are people, basically, this is a fact, who trusted us, who sided with us, and who may be suffering for that. And of course, I'm not in the military, I'm not in the government, I didn't make those decisions. All the same, it undermines your trust. You think, well, what kind of a world do we live in? That it's getting crazier and crazier. And then this is the hot, I mentioned last night, this is the hottest summer on record. This is the hottest July on record. We're on schedule to be the hottest year on record, right? Last year was the hottest year on record. International body that does every 5 or 6 years does a study of climate. Said this is very serious. So all of this undermines our trust. And in your day-to-day life, it can seem as though there's no place to turn for trust. We console ourselves. We console ourselves. We try to do things. I went out to New Mexico this summer. That was wonderful. Wonderful. I went hiking. I had the opportunity to get out. And it felt wonderful. Very, very beautiful experience. And I also had a chance to go up to Vermont, as some of you know. And, being up in Vermont, all of this was very distant. Vermont is very underpopulated and unspoiled, undeveloped. They have very strict zoning, and you can't have billboards. I don't think there are any Walmarts, actually, in Vermont. They've actually sort of zoned them out. So you have these little towns that have all these mom-and-pop stores, like when I was a child. It's very relaxing, very nice. All of that's good, but still, at the back of our minds, there's this fear. You see this person get it, you see this person get it, you see this person get it, and you think, I could get it. I don't mean COVID, I mean whatever. So that kind of situation is frightening, even if we're not directly threatened. So I am so glad that you came to Sashin. Whether you're here in person or you're online. Because there's always something you could do instead. There's always something you could do instead of coming to Sashin. And right now, a lot of people might not feel like coming to Sashin.
Because this is not about productivity on the job. It's important to be productive in your job, but But actually, productivity is not necessarily what we need right now. So even though it's a little bit difficult for people to get out of their ruts because things seem to be falling apart, is what they have to do. We somehow have to create a new way of living, right? This way of living is not working out, And I have to say, I don't think that, by 2030, half the cars on the road are going to be gas, no longer be gas-powered cars. I don't think that's going to solve, I don't think that's going to solve the problem, right? I mean, I don't think that's, because even if we don't have a global climate emergency, right, even if we don't overheat the planet, we're still using up all the resources. We're still having the sixth great extinction, right? So there's a bigger problem behind this little problem. We really need to find a different way to live. And if we don't find a different way to live, we'll just keep repeating the past. And the Buddhist word for that is samsara. The Buddhist word for that is samsara. Samsara means going around and around in a circle. And we, as a civilization, are going around and around in a circle. We're not changing. And, even the people who are supposed to want change are not really wanting change. They're just trying to tinker around the edges. But that doesn't just apply to civilizations or societies or the United States, right? All of these are things that we also do, right? We also do these same things. As things become more frightening, we want to repeat instead of doing what we need to do, which is to create something new. And whether that is a civilization we're talking about, or whether it's a life, your life, right? It's the same situation. Right? So, people are famously addicted to the familiar, right? For a long time, there was a person in our group who would come to Sesshin, and, he would realize, that something about his life really had to change. This person would come to Sesshin, and he about halfway through Sesshin, he began to be honest with himself about his life. He'd say, I have all these dreams, I'm not fulfilling these dreams. And I'm so unhappy that I'm not fulfilling these dreams. And then, I would say, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about that? And he'd say, I can't disappoint my parents. And then at the end of the session, he would go home. And he'd come to another session, and we'd go through the whole thing again, He'd say, about halfway through, he'd say, I want so much to do this. And then, towards the end of the session, he'd even sometimes say, I'm going to do it. Damn it, I'm going to do it. Then he wouldn't do it. And then, a couple sessions later, he'd come to session, and it would be like, I didn't do it, but I'm going to do it. Years go by. Finally, the person stopped sitting and told me. He said, the reason I'm going to stop sitting is because I just can't make this change. I'm changing. I'm dropping out of Zen, and I'm changing my therapist, basically. So, that's very human, right? So human. We're all like that. Me too. We all have that aspect. But, the thing that makes us unhappy, sounds are become so familiar to us. The thing that traps us becomes so familiar to us that we'd rather stay with it than take a risk and change our life, even though we're unhappy. And I think this is true for our society. I don't think our society likes it the way it is. I don't think anybody's happy with our way of life. But people don't change because it's familiar. And as it's falling apart, people want anything, they give anything to go back, right, to what it was 10 years ago or something. But it's not just societies, we're like that too. So something like sashimi is really precious because, we can get a different perspective on things, different perspective. When we live in our everyday life, we are basically playing the role people taught us to play. And we're involved in all of these transactions that are tied in with our identity. So basically, if you are in a business, you're in a business and you go to work and, you do this report and maybe you're really interested in what the report is dealing with. You throw yourself into it, and then you get a bad response, and you're bitterly disappointed and hurt. And part of that is because people are not going to think well of you, right? And that's part of it. And when you turn in the report and you get a good response, everybody says, "Oh my God, you're really a fantastic person." People think well of you. And, on your good days, people think well of you, and on your bad days, people think less well of you. And it's important to be thought well of. This is part of being a human being, right? We live in a world with other people. We want them to like us, we want them at least not to, hate us. And even though it sounds a little cynical to say, all of our feelings are transactional, right? They're highly transactional. Every once in a while, we do something that is not transactional because it lifts us out of that logic, right? I think. So, when you're hiking is a good example. Hiking is that nobody makes any, except for people who work for outfitters and people who are like guides. Nobody really makes any money from hiking. So far, if you're a free climber, you have become a celebrity. Or if you're just a mountain climber, you can become a celebrity. But so far, there aren't too many celebrity hikers. There's a couple of people who have done like the Appalachian Trail in 20 days or something. And they Outside Magazine has tried to turn them into celebrity speed hikers, right? But you don't know their name and I can't even remember it now. And I don't care. Right? So the good thing about hiking is it's not transactional. You go out into the woods and you hike along this trail for 6 days, and you sweat like a pig, and your legs hurt, and you go to bed at night, and you don't sleep well because you're tired. At the end of that process, it's like being lifted up to another plane. And you may have hiked 1,000 times, but the truth is, it isn't samsara. It doesn't go around and around. It's like you disappear. It's like you disappear. Dogen said, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things. 10,000 things. And, you know, you could talk to somebody and say, how did your hike go? And they can say, oh, man, it rained every day. My boots were full of water. And you say, well, would you do it again? Oh, absolutely. You say, why? In Seattle, training at the Seattle Zen Center, there was a movie on about Japanese monks. And some of my friends at the Zen Center went to this movie. And, you know, basically, this reporters or this documentary filmmakers, I should say, interviewed a couple of these monks. And at this temple, there's no heat, there's no central heat. You know, so it's rough, you know, if you've ever been in that situation, it's really rough to be cold day after day, right? That is not fun. And you know, you wear a pretty heavy robe, but, you know, when it was, 28 degrees outside, it's 28 degrees inside. And that's almost like torture, actually, you know, that to be cold like that. Anyway, these poor monks were training at this temple. And the documentary filmmaker said, so why are you doing this? And the monk he interviewed was literally, he was just like speechless. You know, he couldn't say. But the interesting thing is he didn't snap back and run out of the monastery. You know, he said, well, I'm out of here. You know, you're right. You know, I can't even explain why I'm doing this. I think he was doing it because it wasn't, it's not transactional, right? It's lifting us up to a different level. And, you know, at that level, everything looks different. You know, at the 15,000 feet, everything looks very different. You know, I was watching the other night. I came by, I do run the sits at the university because there's good Wi-Fi there. And I drove home after the sit, and Barbara was watching a National Geographic special on the Himalayas. And, you know, basically one of the things David Attenborough said was that all these animals in the Himalayas behave oddly. There was a troop of monkeys, and these monkeys, he said, in the lowlands of India, these monkeys fight all the time, but up in the Himalayas, they don't fight, and they're very cooperative. And he said, you know, ethologists say it's because life is so tough for them, right? You know, that they've developed different habits, you know, living in such a harsh environment, a lot of mutual aid. And maybe that's part of the picture, but, you know, I think, when you look at, when you watch that show, you realize, you know, human concerns are small. You know, and there's another way of living, which is really bigger. Imagine how we would look to aliens. Right? Imagine aliens coming down, and they don't know our language, right? But they see somebody speaking to a crowd of these humans, once humans speaking to a crowd of humans. And you don't know the language, but you're just here. And then all the other recording is loud. And you wouldn't care about the content. You'd say, you know, he said something, and they all got very excited, right? Very excited. And the content wouldn't matter, right? And the interesting thing would be that maybe the guy would say something to the crowd that sounded new and fresh, was over, they'd all go back and do the same old thing, right? No matter what he said. Because it doesn't matter what he said, right? It's only interesting to these little creatures, right? Because he did some variation with language. He used words in a new way, and nobody had used words that way before. And that's interesting to the species, but you know, in the bigger picture, it has no consequences because nobody changes their life. If you look at like the history of art, basically people go to museums and look at paintings. And the painting style changes, right? And artists commit suicide trying to come up with a novel painting style. So somebody like Jackson Pollock, was desperately trying to come up with a new way to paint. And he was so unhappy because he couldn't break through into this original statement. And during a long period of misery, he became an alcoholic. And his alcoholism eventually killed him. But in the process, he did find a new way to paint, right? And his paintings are fantastic. I go to the museum and I look at his paintings. I could just sit there for 50 minutes. I love Jackson Pollock. But you weren't a human, if you came from another planet, you go into museum. People go into the museum and they look at these paintings. There's pieces of canvas covered with pieces of fabric covered with pigment, and they look and they start chattering, and then they go home, right? And that's the end. So it looked like a momentous change, right? Jackson Pollock came up with this new style, and it was absolutely amazing, and everybody was chattering. But then somebody else comes along and they put Jackson Pollock in the same room with Mark Rothko and a few other people. And people go to the museum and look at the fabric covered with pigment, and nothing changes. So there's a way of getting so caught up in the human, getting so caught up in all of this, and you kill yourself if you get a bad review from a critic. And Pollock would actually be depressed for days if he didn't get a good note from the critics. But, Jackson Pollock is just words on a page now. His life is over. And somebody else is important, right? There's new critics and so on. But nothing has really changed. So my feeling is that we spend a lot of our time at that level, sort of like the ground, the down at the sea level, right? But, when we come to Sashin, it's like a goal of 14,000 feet, and everything looks very different because we realize, it doesn't really matter if I get a bad review from the critics or not. That's a nearly sea level perspective, right? It doesn't matter in a certain way. When I'm down at the sea level, and I get it, I've spent 5 years painting this painting, and a critic gives me a bad note, that hurts, and it hurts. And you can't just say it doesn't hurt because it hurts. But, when you go to the top of the mountain, you realize this doesn't matter. Because now you're in a different place. I was reading about this British guy who lived out in the wilds of, where he was, but he spent like 3 years like pretty much in isolation in the wilderness. And his project was to write a book based on his wilderness experiences. But he said, the more he was out in the wilderness, the less he wanted to write. And he said, after a while, I didn't think of myself at all. I was going to write this book about my reflections and my thoughts out in the natural world alone in the natural world. But when I was alone in the natural world, I wasn't really interested in my thoughts. Now, I didn't care. It was like my self-referencing disappeared and I felt like part of something larger than myself. And I think that's what Zen is partly all about. Right? It's like going up that mountain. You know, we do have to live a good life. You know, you do want to try and do something that makes a contribution to humankind. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. And it is important to have a meaningful life. It's important to read books. It's important to have relationships. Those are all important. But it's also important to be part of something bigger, right? And when we come to Zen, we realize, you know, the world, the universe, is much bigger than we thought. You know, it's actually much bigger, much, much bigger than we thought. And, you know, that really we get too caught up in the red dust. We get too caught up in the squeaks and squeals at the sea level, right? And we don't participate in the great vista of the 14,000 foot view. Right? But Zen is about, you know, it isn't just about the 14,000 foot view. But part of it is getting to that place where you suddenly realize, you know, there's a bigger life. There's a bigger life than all this. There's a number of people in our room, you know, who are not here because they're in very bad health. You know, and, you know, everybody at the end of their life has not done certain things. And has done other things. But I think it's really, really, really important to go to the top of the mountain. And I have to say that, you know, it's very costly to go to the top of the mountain. You know, it takes a lot of time and energy, and there's absolutely no reward except going to the top of the mountain. It's like hiking, right? You know, you lose money hiking. You don't get a reputation, you know, you get bitten by mosquitoes and biting flies and so on. But you realize you're part of something vast, right? The vastness that underlies us all, right? And we realize that what we live for, gain and loss, right and wrong, you know, we live to, it makes us small. It makes us small. So, it's possible, you know, at Sesshin, I think uniquely possible to encounter this vastness that underlies us all, this huge openness that is really what we really are, what we really are. We've constructed this world, this artificial world, and we call it reality. And, you know, those Zen people are over there doing something on the margins of reality. But, you know, actually, the ordinary world is very small, and this world is very great, right? Vast. And we have come here to climb the top of the mountain, right? You know, we may not get there today, or tomorrow, or by Sunday, but we're climbing the top of the mountain, and we get the cool mountain air, right? You know, we feel the cool mountain and we feel the air of freedom. You know, I am current because I have had to be current. You know, my parents gave me that name and my driver's license says current. My social security card says current. When I go to work, I am current. But actually, I am not current. That's part of who I am. But I have no name, really. You know, I have no age. You know, I am, you know, part of the sky. I am part of it all, right? That's my true self. And, you know, we have the sutras talk about upside down views. We have upside down views. You know, we live in the small and we forget about the great, the large. we get so caught up in the stuff down below, we forget about the mountain. In fact, we can't even see the mountain because it's covered with clouds. But you came today to be part of the mountain. To be part of the mountain. And it's so wonderful to be on the mountain. It's so wonderful. Introduction. I always admire the novel devices of Yunfeng. All his life he pulled out nails and wedges for people. In other words, he was always helping people, right? Yunfeng was always helping people. So why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? So, you know, always helping people, but every once in a while, you know, he'd put out a bowl of glue and say, come and get it, lunch, free lunch. Or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road. Why did he do that? See, it's, you know, we get caught up, we get trapped, right? And when we get trapped, we suddenly realize, this is not the right way to live. This is not the right way to live. But, you know, unfortunately, what we do is we try to repeat. You know, we try to repeat, even if it doesn't work. Because when we're scared, we go back to what we know. When we're frightened, when we feel like we're losing something, we go back to what we know. So sometimes the teacher has to set out a bowl of food, you know, or dig a hole in the road. But sometimes life does that for us. And people keep falling for it until they get tired of falling for it, and then they look for something else. And Monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumer. See, so the monk is asking a technical question about meditation practice. When I'm sitting on the cushion, if I'm in a truly thoughtful state, am I generating any karma or not? See? When I'm on the cushion and I'm in truly a thoughtless state, am I free from karma? See? Basically, am I now free from karma? I'm not producing any karma, right? So the monk is actually taking something vast and grand and he's turning it into something small. He's turning it, you know, he's taken Zen practice, which is this opportunity to get outside gain and loss, right and wrong, and he's turning it into gain and loss, right and wrong. And I can't tell you how many people do that, right? It's so common. You know, people, when they start working with their breath and they're trying to get their breath right, me too, I did the same thing. You're trying to get the breath right. So should I breathe like this or should I breathe like that? But really, you just have to surrender to the breath. You just have to let the breath take control. Lose yourself in your breath. See, what we want to do is control the breath. We want to control, do it right. And doing it right means that somebody will say, ah, oh, you're doing it right. But that's samsara. That's samsaric thinking. So when you become one with the breath, it no longer matters whether it is quote-unquote right or not right. So the monk has taken something which could have opened up into a 16,000-foot view, and he's down at sea level. And he's saying, when I'm not producing a single thought, have I now freed myself from karma? And Yunmen says, stop. He says, forget about it. Become one with. Right? He says, who cares about your goddamn breath? Mount Sumer. Mount Sumer. Not for producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunman's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide, the white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as the tip of a hair in there. A phony cockroach can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion.